Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. How much do you know about what has taken place in Egypt since the start of 2011? Well, through the news, we only get a glimpse of the bloodiest battle, or an election, or a million-man march. At the beginning of August 2013, we witnessed the second president deposed within the space of 3 years. But what have these events, how have these events evolved on the ground, and even more, how have they felt? I saw a film recently that answers some of those questions, not literally. Too much has happened too fast to do that. This is not a look back, not an analysis. The documentary The Square puts you in Tahrir Square as revolution swirls around you. From the overthrow of a 30-year dictator through military rule and culminating with the forced military removal of the Muslim Brotherhood president in the summer of 2013, the film follows a handful of Egyptian activists as they battle leaders and regimes and risk their lives to build a new society of conscience. And I have the privilege of speaking with three of the principals involved in the making of that film and that revolution. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, and culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Before graduating from Harvard, Egyptian-American filmmaker Jehan Nujaim was awarded the Gardner Fellowship for Mokattam, an Arabic film she directed about a garbage-collecting village near Cairo, Egypt. Jehan then joined the MTV News and Documentary Division as a segment producer for the documentary series Unfiltered. She soon left her position at MTV to produce and direct the critically acclaimed and award-winning feature documentary Startup.com. Her 2004 feature documentary, Control Room, was a critical and audience success and won her the coveted TED Prize in 2006. Now, each TED Prize winner is granted a wish to change the world, and Jehan's wish was to create a day in which the power of film could bring people from all over the world together to form a global community and perhaps form a new understanding of each other. This day was Pangea Day, a live video conference featuring music, film, and speakers that took place in Cairo, New York, Rio de Janeiro, as well as other cities in over 100 countries. The Square, the Sundance Audience award-winning film chronicling the heart of the Egyptian Revolution, is her fifth feature-length documentary. Welcome, Jehan.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And Karim Amer is an Egyptian-American entrepreneur raised between Miami, Florida, and Cairo, Egypt. Karim graduated from NYU in 2005 with dual majors in economics and political science and a minor in entertainment, media, and technology. On January 28, 2011, Karim joined fellow Egyptians in Tahrir Square. Amer created and co-founded two initiatives for Egypt, Gesur and Dostur 2011, and I'll let him explain during the interview what each of those is. British-Egyptian actor and filmmaker Khalid Abdallah, star of The Kite Runner, United 93, and Green Zone, inspired by the activism of his father, who was jailed in Egypt in the 70s and has lived in exile, Khalid leaves his life in London to join the revolution. Welcome, Karim and Khaled.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So the first thing I want to do, I've given some brief highlights, but I want each of you to tell us in your own words a bit about your path before you entered the square, up to the point at which you entered the square. Then the rest of the interview will be about what happened after. Jehan. And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that kind of thing. Go into the background of who you are.
Who I am in 3 minutes or less. Okay, so I was born in the States, actually, to an American mother and an Egyptian father, and moved as a baby to Kuwait and then to Egypt in 1980 at the age of 8 years old. And lived in Egypt for 10 years. And then went to the States for school, for boarding school and college, went there to be a doctor, as a good Egyptian daughter should do when she gets into a good school, and went and took organic chemistry and failed miserably and decided that there were other people that probably should be doing that kind of work.
Is that still Chem 6?
It was Chem 5, oh. and then started Orgo, and I was like, this is not working for me. I took refuge in the dark room and started doing a lot of photography. I actually had my first exhibit in Egypt at this conference on population and development, and people, organizers of the conference, were so upset by the photographs that they got removed. And, you know,
I just want you to know that we're learning things here.
That's excellent.
I was told, you know, how can you be a, you know, you call yourself an Egyptian, but why are you showing these dirty, horrible parts of the country? And why aren't you showing the pyramids and all of the beautiful sides of the country? And I walked away feeling, you know, pretty bad, but at the same time kind of intrigued by the fact that I was a kid, had not even opened my mouth, and yet these images had provoked such conflict and debate among people. So it made me really want to pursue visual arts. So I went and did that and ended up graduating in visual arts and philosophy. And then I left and went and made this short film about Mu'attam, which is a garbage collecting village in Egypt. And then I came back to New York and got a job working for MTV Unfiltered, which was basically the pre-YouTube YouTube kind of thing, where we'd send out cameras to kids and they would film their stories and we would edit them. So it was, I guess, the very first kind of YouTube type show, but properly edited. And
it was what Current aimed to be, right?
Right, right. Very much like that, actually. At a certain point, got really tired of looking at shaky camera work and decided I wanted to do my own stuff. Not that at that time my camera work was any less shaky.
Or that there isn't a lot of shaky camera work in the square, obviously.
That's true. A lot of running around. And was so lucky to be able to... I started making a film about my roommate at the time, who was starting an internet company. And basically there were checks for hundreds of thousands of dollars coming in to his mailbox. And he was living out of this messy room with no product whatsoever. And I was very intrigued that this could, you know, that he could be doing this. So I decided to start following him and thought at the beginning, this could be a business school case study. If, you know, I didn't know if it would be a film at the time. But then I met Chris Hedgedis and D.A. Pennebaker, who I talked to about how do you raise funding for this kind of thing. And they at the time wanted to make a film about the internet. And they were making a film about the funders of these kids. And so we decided to partner, which was an amazing thing because they were basically like mentors. That was like partnering with, you know, people that I would study.
And exactly, yeah.
They were incredible. I made startup.com with them. And saw that people in theaters that we show, you know, it was released theatrically in the UK, in the US and Australia. And people were so curious about the characters and what happened to them and their stories and their lives. And I just thought as an Egyptian American, our culture and our part of the world is so deeply misunderstood. If I'm able to make a film that really brings out what people's passions and beliefs are, then this is something that I would be really exciting. So the next film, I worked on a couple of other people's films for a bit, and then the next film I made was Control Room. And that was really when the Iraq War was happening, and I felt, how are people even supposed to communicate with each other when they're, the news from different places, from the West and from the Arab world, is so completely different. The stories are so completely different. I want to be in the center of that. So I went and made a film that where I was traveling between Al Jazeera and Central Command. And that was released in 2004. And after that, won the TED Prize, as you said, and did this kind of crazy worldwide production in over 100 countries of the world, 1,800 locations, asked people around the world, if you had 5 minutes of the world's attention, what story would you tell? Got, you know, short films, thousands and thousands of them. And this is coming from a wish for the, you know, what would you want to do in your life? So I have to say, as I watched like thousands of short films from all these places in the world, I was like, I can't believe that this is what I've decided should be my wish. But we put together 4 hours of amazing programming and we did this. And for a disorganized person to put together a worldwide event in 1,800 locations in over 100 countries of the world was kind of, you know, a major feat. I had a lot of amazing help from people, but decided I never wanted to put together a film festival again. And
right.
I wanted to
be careful. Be careful what you wish for.
Exactly. That was exactly it. And then after Pangea, I made a film with a very close friend of mine, actually my initial boss at MTV, Mona El Dayef. We made a film called Rafia, Solar Mamas, which is about a Jordanian woman that travels to India from Jordan to learn how to become a solar engineer and returns to light her village. But as I was making this film, I was back in Egypt at the time, and the rumblings start to happen. Oh, I left out actually one story, which is very pertinent to actually what I'm doing now, which is that before Rafia, I made a film called Egypt, We Are Watching You, which was about three women fighting against corruption in elections in Egypt and for political change. And this film was released on BBC and around the world as part of something called the Why Democracy Project. And it was about the democracy or whatever version of democracy in 10 different countries of the world. So anyway, when I was back in Cairo, as the rumblings were happening, I was talking to these women that I'd made the film about previously, and they said the 25th was going to be big. So there we go. There we are. To the point of right before January 25th, 2011, when I went to Davos at the time because I thought I wanted to be with the leadership of Egypt rather than on the streets, because I knew that there'd be lots of cameras on the streets anyway. Went to Davos, none of the leadership showed up, so I had to get back to Cairo as quickly as possible. So I got back to Cairo and got detained along the way, then made my way to the square and started shooting, met an incredible cast of characters which would lead me through the story, and met my entire team there. And that's where the story begins.
Amazing, amazing. Thank you. Thank you for that. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. And the voice you just heard was Jahan Nujeem. She is the director of The Square, the film that we're talking about, which takes place in Tahrir Square over the course of the tumultuous events that have happened since that day, since January 25th. The other two voices you will hear are Karim Amir, producer, and Khaled Abdallah, an actor who put his career on pause to participate in the revolution. And you can learn more at thesquarefilm.com. And right now, it's opened in New York. It's opened in L.A. And check thesquarefilm.com to find out when it's going to come to your city or when a screening might be available, that sort of thing. Okay. Same question, Karim Amir.
Okay, so how did I get to the square, basically?
Who am I before I show up at the square?
Well, I was born in Egypt, and my parents moved to the United States when I was about 5 years old, and I grew up basically between the U.S. And Cairo, starting off in Los Angeles, actually, for a brief stint, and then making our way all the way to Miami, Florida, which is where I spent the bulk of my American life here. And I think I am someone who grew up constantly between two narratives of identity, between my Egyptian identity and my American identity living here. And you know, seeing them mutually coexist and not seeing them having to pick one over the other.
How often did you get back and forth?
I would go back, I mean, it was literally the day school would be out, my mother would say, now you guys have to go back, because she was very worried that we'd lose our identity. And so it was very, there was a conscious effort to constantly make us in touch with Egypt. And so even though my house in Miami was an extension of Egypt, I mean, you'd walk into my house and you'd feel like you were in the Middle East. So that is how it started. And in college in New York, I was very interested in getting involved in entertainment. But of course, coming from a traditional family, the idea of entertainment was very, very, you know, it's just like, what are you talking about entertainment? So I was able to slip it in as a minor.
Right.
And I knew it was my passion, but, you know, coming from a more traditional background, I realized that there were a lot of other things I needed to do first before I could pursue something like that. And so I lived a kind of much more serious life, according to the book, for quite a number of years, and had started a few successful entrepreneurial endeavors, and had started up a company in Egypt, actually. And so I'd been living in Egypt for 3 years before the revolution, between Egypt and Shanghai, actually, of all places. Yeah, it's a long, crazy story. So I get back from Shanghai and, you know, living in my dual life between the two cities. And it's just, you know, just finished New Year's Eve and the rumblings started happening. And I went down as someone who was a skeptic, actually. So I was not a believer that any political change could happen. I thought that, you know, living in America and seeing, you know, I felt like I had appreciated the political change. I had appreciated democratic values. But I think that my experience of the pursuit of those values in America was something that was very distant. So like this was, there was this idea that change was something that had been fought for before, it had been accomplished. And in any attempts as a young person living in America to pursue change, whether it was marching against the war in Iraq or signing petitions or anything of that sort, I never felt that it had accomplished anything. So I didn't value my own efficacy to change the political process. And so coming into Tahrir Square, I went down as a skeptic.
What sort of companies, Karim?
Oh, so
what sort of field?
Yeah, so the field I was operating in was in – we have a company that does design and build for commercial like real estate projects. So we handle we're basically – we take the design of the architects and interior designers and manage that process into the actual construction process. So like project management is what we were doing, me and my partner. And so it was kind of taking the creative process and trying to make it come to terms with the reality.
Well, which
is essentially what I found production to be as well, you know, this in between.
You were in the middle of redesigning the biggest hospital in Egypt.
Yeah, we were doing the largest hospital in Cairo at the time, the renovation of it. So it was we were very deeply in the country. We knew very well mm-hmm. what was going on.
Mm-hmm. While the hospital was still running, so if you cut the wrong wire, you could cut off somebody's life. So, you know, similar.
So I'm used to high-stress environments, yeah.
Yeah, project management with life or death consequences. Film believes that's the case, even though it's not. Let me just tell people again, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. That was the voice of Karim Amer, producer of The Square, telling us again sort of his life before he ended up in Tahrir Square. And now the third principal from the film The Square, who's with me in the studio today, Khaled Abdallah, your story.
How far back do you want me to go?
Well, you saw how far back I went.
Yeah, no,
I
know,
I
know.
To birth.
No.
Yeah, I didn't know how to do that either.
But. Yeah, but, you know, the moments that matter.
I mean, there are so many, though. I mean, you know, I mean, I mean, the moments that matter, as I've discovered, precede me. You know, I mean, they start really before I'm born. And if you want, if I can take you from the moment where I first go down, which is the moment at which I feel that, you know, my father is holding me by one hand and my grandfather is holding me by the other. And actually something that you find in the midst of a revolution is that in a strange way, something of time collapses. Your stories, your life, your narratives, what you're fighting for is far beyond your moment as an individual. And it's an extraordinary thing to learn, and also to learn to live by and to live for something, you know, that is bigger than you. For me, and in my family, that story really starts with my grandfather, who, was politically active on the left in Egypt, fighting for social reform, in Egypt. And imprisoned several times through his life, but he was fighting from the 40s onwards. My father, too, who was a leading figure in the student movement in the 70s in Egypt, who was imprisoned many times, fighting for what he believes in. And that's why I end up being born abroad in Glasgow, brought up in the UK. My family moved down when I was 4, down to London, which is where I spent most of my life, not expecting to enter the world of film or of acting or of theatre. But one day a teacher comes up to me in school and says, I'm doing this play and I think you'll be really good in it. and I tell him he's completely mad. I haven't acted in anything since I did a nativity play.
We all did a nativity play.
I know, we all did. I go and do the audition, and I get a good, and I get the part. And I remember the very first rehearsal that we did in this classroom, and I remember the square being laid out on, you know, within the classroom, everything pushed aside, and the rules within that square were completely different to everything else. And I remember, you know, I knowing that the moment I entered that place, that something in me was never turning back.
And how old were you at that point?
I was 15.
Okay.
15, 16. I continue. I was very lucky. I had some great teachers at school and used to go to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And had an extraordinary teacher called Philip Swan, who had an amazing theatre company on the Fringe that won 4 consecutive 5-star reviews and had a West End transfer, you know, West End being like Broadway, with a bunch of school kids, which was unheard of. And one of which as well I directed, making me the youngest director to get 5 stars on the Fringe. And I continued basically thinking that theatre was going to be my life. But also understanding, because there is this thread in my life of politics, you know, understanding that politics is part of, you know, is shaping me and is shaping the questions that people ask about me. The very first demonstration I remember going on was a demonstration, it was a pro-Palestinian demonstration in which I was on my father's shoulders. Political discussions were going through my household all the time. When we would enter Egypt, my father would spend longer than everyone else to come through immigration. You know, all of these stories visit my life. My life professionally as an actor starts in the wake of 9/11. My professional career, I enter university in 2000. 9/11 happens in 2001. By the time I've left university, the US and UK and others are bombing Iraq. I never expected to enter the world of film. I thought my world was theatre, for a variety of reasons. And I'd never, although I'd been aware of my identity, I didn't really, and I had these issues of the disconnect and being aware that in some way I'm a translator between cultures. I didn't see professionally that that was what I was going to do. But cutting a long story short, one day as I am actually planning to begin putting a production of Hamlet together, which I'm going to direct, I get a call asking me to audition for a film called United 93. And at first I think to myself, I want nothing to do with this. But then I found out the director is Paul Greengrass and that he's made a film called Bloody Sunday, which I think is an extraordinary piece of filmmaking and in the tradition of some of the greatest films I know, like The Battle of Algiers and otherwise.
Agreed.
And I think to myself, okay, maybe this man is going to do something different. I audition, I'm irritatingly recalled, and I go in and meet him. And I say to him, if you're making the film that I'm worried that you could be making, I have no interest in doing it, and I think anyone that's making it is a bastard. And he's sitting there, and the producers are sitting there. And he asks me, and we have a conversation, and he asks me a question that I think I've been trying to answer for the rest, and will continue to try and answer for the rest of my life. He says, do you think it's possible to make this film correctly? And this is 4 years after, this is 4 years after 9/11 and at the height of war. And we talk about many things, and he tells me the way in which he's hoping to make this film. And I leave the audition thinking, wow, if they offer me the part, I'm going to do it. But I have to just, for a second, ask myself, do I feel up to the responsibilities of the role and of the place that, you'll be fitting in terms of the, you know, the culture of the world and the stories that it tells itself about itself. And I feel like I'm going to try. And that's, you know, and there's, you know, we can get into long stories about United 93. We can get into long stories about the Kite Runner. We can get into long stories about Green Zone. But if you like, there's this fault line in the world that I'm traveling through. 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq, the identity politics of these issues, the way in which we humanize and dehumanize parts of the world that we go to war in. And I make a lot of, as far as I'm concerned, difficult decisions as to how to follow those lines. And I have a career in Hollywood, which is something I never expected. And then one day I get a script through from, just as The Kite Runner is just about to open and just as Green Zone is about to be filmed, I get a script, and it's from an Egyptian filmmaker who is wanting to do an independent film in Egypt. And I'm a little bit skeptical because most Egyptian films really aren't very good. Anyway, they keep asking me to read it, and I do, and it's clear that it's trying to do something very different. I end up doing the film. I go to Cairo. I meet a community of filmmakers who are the beginning of a new wave of alternative cinema in Egypt. And I meet them, and they have something in them which knows more about me than I know about myself. And I sign up. And we spend the next 2 years of our life making a film that we thought was going to take 3 months to shoot, called In the Last Days of the City, in which I play a documentary filmmaker who's making a film about his city and joined by friends from Iraq and Lebanon. And we finish shooting 6 weeks before the revolution starts. And I'd filmed in pretty much every single demonstration that had happened in Egypt. And I go home in early December, thinking now is time to be back in the UK and concentrate on the other part of me.
Right, maybe finally direct Hamlet.
Well, and yeah, exactly. Like I have designs on directing and making my own projects and doing that kind of thing. And I spent 2 weeks completely ill from this 2-year marathon that I've been through that wasn't supposed to last 2 years. And then the 25th of January happens, and I find myself completely and utterly split. All the people who I've been working with, all the people who I know, are on the street. I can't get through to them. The telephone lines have been cut, and I don't know what to do. And I get through and talk to them at 4 a.m. Their voices are hoarse. They've been, you know, shouting. Some people I know have been arrested. And what you have to know is that at that moment, the 25th of January, something happened that nobody expected, obviously. But there was something on the 25th of January, which is that up until that point, demonstrations had taken place, but at the end of the demonstration, everyone went home. The most important day for me wasn't the 25th, it was the 26th. And on the 26th of January, a very small number of people continued. And it was at that point that you knew that what was about to come was completely and utterly different to everything that we'd had before. The 25th of January was a Tuesday, 26th was a Wednesday. You knew that Friday was going to be huge because Friday is the big day of protest. So everyone's going to relax on Thursday and get ready for Friday. And I spent the 26th of January thinking, what the hell am I going to do? Am I going to go? Am I not going to go? Am I going to... And I booked my plane on the 26th. I arrive just after midnight on the 27th, have a stamp in my passport which says the 28th of January, which ended up being, as we call it, the day of rage. And the following day, I'm on the street.
Thank you. That's the voice of Khalid Abdallah, who put his career on pause, as you heard, to participate in the revolution.
I do, but this is the thing. I don't say that I put my career on pause. And I don't say that because this is what I'm fighting for. My career and what I want to do is about what I believe in. It's not about whether I appear on a camera, in front of a camera, or whether I'm behind a camera, or whether I'm on this radio station, or whether I'm whatever. There is something so much bigger than all of us that I'm trying to participate in fighting for. And that is what I want to make my career. And sometimes, you could say it's the activist in me that is making films that are about changing people's perceptions about the region that I'm from. And you could say it is the actor in me that picks up a camera to go out onto the streets to document the abuses of state and authority. Unless we solve the problems that are about our world and how we hold power accountable, and unless we take charge of our stories, then forget it. We are basically handing ourselves over to people who do not represent us. If you like, in all cases, it's about representation, whether it's about representation in front of the camera, or whether it's about, representation in government or on the street. We come from an identity which is voiceless in many parts of the world. Or if it's not voiceless, it's voiced by someone else.
Well, just as the line that I read, which you declined to agree with, is, I mean, that's a narrative that one puts together, putting together a PR package, and your counter is, that's not my narrative anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's like if you work in Arabic film or film that has any relationship with Arab or Arabic identity, the idea that you can just sort of sit at home and wait for a script to turn up, which for some, you know, within certain parts of the industry can be the case, but for someone of my background, it's ludicrous. You have to participate in making the stories or in solving the many infrastructural problems that exist about why that script doesn't just turn up on your door, and that's something. You know, that's something I learned, thankfully, very early on. But, I guess some of the instincts were there in place. I'm a restless creature.
Okay. We're at about the halfway point. Let me just say, first of all, that I really appreciate the fact that each of you was willing to take as long and go as deep into your stories as you were. Because, as I say, people will or will not see the film. They will read reviews and so on. But the chance to actually get a sense of who you are, who the people are when they're not on screen or they're not behind the camera, to me is something which I always want to capture. And people are often shy to actually really go into it. This is Freeform. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with three of the principals involved in the powerful, award-winning documentary, The Square, about the events over the course of the last 2 years in Tahrir Square in Cairo. With me in studio are Jahan Nujaim, director, Karim Amir, producer, and the last voice you heard was Khaled Abdallah, an actor, and we'll say an actor in his life at this point.
I get actor, I get activist, I get filmmaker, I get cultural producer, we all carry these multiple identities,
exactly.
And it's like
exactly.
Whichever one's most useful right now.
Exactly.
The thing is when you live between two parts of the world like this and you're able to be local in both parts, it makes you break the narrative already, because you find a way that you can mutually coexist. And so I think that all of us have that kind of that mixed background, and so we can't fit into the box of
That's
like
right.
This is who you are.
Well,
and
not only that, but my guess is that you also contend with the fact that people constantly meet you with a narrative they've brought.
Absolutely. My first week of university was 9/11, so I mean I lived it. I
Welcome.
Know exactly what it was like. So
Welcome to NYU.
It was a very interesting it was a rude awakening, so to speak, onto who I was.
And not just college, but college in New York City.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean and because when I was, appalled at what had happened, of course, but was getting attacked for being appalled because I was somehow a part of this and accused of being, this, how are you upset? You're a part. This is your fault because of who I was, the way I looked and my name and my religion and whatnot. So it's I think you know, all three of us have been really defined by these events and this duality that
yeah.
exists.
Yeah.
And you have a foot inside and outside always, I think, which is about, it relates to being a filmmaker and observing and
which is always a foot in and out. Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay, so we know who's here.
Can we just say something about the name of this show?
Yes.
Because I think if we're talking about Tahrir Square and the film The Square, I think that a show called A World That Might Work is just might work. The irony is just, you know, is pretty incredible.
It's perfect.
Because that's what it was about. I mean,
This is home.
Exactly. Like, the beginning of Tahrir, when we went down, I mean, there was that feeling, and you see it in the film where the roof.
Ahmed says, you know, we all dreamed that maybe one day all of Egypt could be just like Tahrir Square.
And I mean, what you see, there's so much here. And I have to correct people, you know, when people say, oh, that thing you say, a world that works. I say, no. It might and it just might. But it's an invitation and a challenge. It's not a promise.
Exactly.
And that's what all of this is. And what you say about Ahmed, who is a phenomenal character in the film, and I'm going to ask you next about the other characters, who they are and how you chose them, because it is that handful in addition to Khaled. But what you see, and I guess we see it from a distance in the headlines, in the news and so on, but what you see so clearly in the film is how it never really stops. And it's always about to break or about to move forward or about to be shattered or about to be overrun. And it's that feeling. And Ahmed just so well personifies that one of time to go to the square again. You know, I can remember, actually, I predate all of you and went to college in the 60s. And at a completely different level compared to what, you know, Egypt has been through. But I remember, it was, well, time to head down to, you know, Harvard Square or Washington or New York. You know, it's, you know, mm-hmm. the call is out. Let's go.
My mother marched on Washington. And so I think, I mean, when these events were happening, if she was very, very emotionally involved. She's American, but she was very, as somebody living in, who had lived in Egypt for over 30 years, was very involved and really harkened back to what she had felt during that time in the 60s.
So, keeping with a little bit what you won't see in the film, but what's underneath it kind of, is how did you meet, I'm asking Jahan now, how did you meet the folks who became those principals and how did you choose them and then tell us about them?
Well, we were all sleeping next to each other in a square, so that's
And
really
you mean pretty much
happened.
Literally,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, I do. And we all met... Well, okay, basically, how do you look for a character that you want to spend the next, you don't know how long, it's going to be maybe a year, 2 years, 3 years. Well, you'd better feel like you're learning something from them. You have to like them. You've sort of fallen in love with them. They have to be somebody that surprises you, that challenges you, because if they're not doing that, then you're not going to be challenging an audience. Or
they'll end up cut.
Exactly. Exactly. And they have to be people that you root for and want to be following because that's the way that, you know, that's you want an audience to connect to them. And if you're connecting to them, you hope that you'll be able to make a story in which an audience connects to. So Ahmed and I met, a friend of mine was making a news piece about him, and I met him and just fell in love with him. I mean, he's just a magical personality.
Ahmed Hassan.
Yes.
How old is he during the course of this film? I couldn't tell.
When I met him, he was 22, 23.
Okay.
And then the film lasts 3 years. So, and he really grows up in the film. Magdi, I met again in the square. He was right next to the tent that we were hanging out in. And he was fascinating because he would go up to Pierre's apartment. Pierre is somebody that I've known for a long time who has this apartment that overlooks Tahrir Square. and he owns the building. And he's sort of one of the unsung heroes of the revolution because he allowed for a number of the revolutionaries to come crash at his place. He also allowed for the media to use his balcony to constantly be filming what was going on in the square, because he felt like if you could have international news cameras on the square at all times, that would be a kind of protection for the kids and everybody in the square. Anyway, Pierre is Coptic Christian and Magdi is Muslim and from the Muslim Brotherhood. And so he would go up, and Magdi first went up there to hang a flag from the side. The list of demands were hung from the side of Pierre's balcony. And Magdi and Pierre would get into these discussions. And they were fascinating because here, you know, here's a country that I've grown up in where people did not speak politically with each other in the open, really. I mean, we've lived under emergency law for, 30 years. So this discussion was happening, and I was curious to, I'd never really sat with somebody from the Muslim Brotherhood before. And so meeting somebody who was so open-minded and excited to connect to different people, I wanted to follow Magdi. I met Khalid through his wife, Cressida True, who was his girlfriend at the time. And
we've been together 10 years, though, so it's not like it was it was not like the film was the cause of the romance.
which of course,
it would make
story
a good story. Yeah. Although we did film their wedding.
We did.
And engagement.
Cressida filmed their engagement, But I started talking with her about what was going on, and she said, you know, you really should speak with Khalid. And so I started speaking with him, and he was incredibly, like, deeply involved with what was going on and deeply passionate about what was happening, and also incredibly articulate during what to me was a very confusing time.
Chaotic and so on. Yes, yes.
So I asked him if I could follow him.
Did you?
I asked you that. You were like, yeah, yeah, sure. And then I talked with Cressida, because Cressida was she was deciding whether she was going to stay in Cairo or go back to the UK. And I said, and she wanted to start working in film. And so we had this conversation, and I said, well, maybe you want to follow Khalid. And she was like, yeah, I could do that.
That's amazing. We live together. It's like, it's so easy.
You just have a camera. And that's how we had such unbelievable access.
And I don't know when Khalid, you know, started this thing, whether he really agreed to waking up camera facing him
He doesn't even.
Or how long
it
last.
The thing I say is, I guess there are other actors who've experienced this, but I've really discovered that it is much harder to be, you know, yourself in a documentary than it is to play a character in a fiction film. It's a very different, and not least as well, because as an actor, I think everyone is, but certainly as an actor, part of your craft is to be very sensitive to moments that feel false. And one thing I find very hard about being filmed in a documentary is the moment where you feel like a camera is there asking you to perform for it, so it's almost like it's intervening. And so I would always run away whenever that felt the case, or I would just shut up, because what I wanted to do was do what I was doing.
Right.
And so as a result, really, what the film captures is it actually captures moments that are honest, you know, and that are what I would have been doing regardless of whether the camera was there or not. Unless you have moments, obviously, where the camera acknowledges itself and asks you a question, which is different. The fact that it was Cressida helped. But actually, Jehen filmed me too.
I did.
There's this one moment in the film where I kind of remember it, but, you know, I remember that moment very much. I was deeply focused on the work I was doing, and Jehen was just there upstairs at Pierre's, and we were working on uploading some of the kind of key footage from what had been happening in the square and the killing that had taken place and the various abuses and stuff, and she's filming me, and I'm so intent. And eventually, she asks me a question and I just respond in one line and that's it. And the line's in the film. That's hard, you know. Anyway.
And it's also hard to find, you know, to keep track of how you're going to not only find your characters, but continue on in the making of a film like this. You know, I mean, we had, we were driven by our kind of sense of purpose and also a lot of luck of having a lot of incredible people come together. And every time something was needed, someone would appear. You know, like our DP we met in the square, Hamdi, who came in and taught us how to use the cameras, because it was the first time that people were using these DSLR cameras, and you were allowed to use them because the army felt like they were photography cameras. And so he came in and helped us. We met our editor in the square. We met, you know, the people like Zag and Ahmed, who were, you know, young college students who started protesting and camping out, who learned how to do sound. So, you know,
the whole crew came together in the square. I mean, actually, I started following Karim because I thought that what he was doing was quite interesting, because he was doing with his cousin, he was trying to do an online crowdsourced constitution. And he was setting up
We had a lot of crazy ideas.
He was setting up
The whole country had crazy ideas at the time, but
he was setting up also a stage in the square. There was the Brotherhood stage and sort of the Lefty stage, and they were setting up. So I was following him, and after about a week, he said, you know, I don't think I want to be a character in the film, but I want to be a producer, and I think you guys desperately need a producer.
So I didn't know what that meant at the time, that it was going to be 2.5 years later and my entire savings. But yeah, it's been an amazing ride, I think. And again, you know, we've had such an amazing group of people come together to make this film. And at a certain point, it became more than just a film. And I think that was kind of the spirit of why we were able to continue and how we were able to get so much incredible people to devote their lives to it. You know, we have 1,600 hours of material now that's been shot by our team, because what the sense was that you're documenting a moment in history and you hope to make a great film in the end, but at the same time, you have a responsibility.
Well, I think actually you just said in the end. My sense is that there is no end. you have documented something, and some of it becomes this film. But that documentation remains, and the future may change the present and may change the past in a way that stuff that wasn't in this cut becomes important in something else. Now, I'm going to go to you, Jehan. When did you want the film to end, and did events overtake you? And I guess I'll leave it open to you. It seems to me that this film, in a way, doesn't end, that as events change, either there's a 2.0 or there's a new version. Or tell me how you're approaching it.
Well, we're constantly trying to figure out what the ending was and what the ending would be. And the first time that we all really allowed it to end was when Morsi came to power, and it became this political story from, you know, the bringing down of a dictator to the election of a president. And then the ending...
But it was a kind of unsatisfying ending.
It was sort of unsatisfying because, right, yeah,
it was... As it was an unsatisfying reality.
Exactly, because then, you know, he then went on to use the tools of democracy to establish another dictatorship. And all of the people that we were following were back in the streets again. And it became a much deeper, more interesting story, because it became about holding power accountable and fighting against fascism, whether the face of that fascism is Mubarak or the military or the Muslim Brotherhood. So it became very important to include that final chapter.
Mind you, we're supposed to be taking the film to Sundance a week later.
Things are changing.
History would not be on our side in that sense. And we had a very critical decision to make of what do you do? Do you make the better film for Sundance and go into your post-production and start all the procedures and things? Or do you make the film for history and go back and start filming? Or do you just cancel Sundance? So we called our executive producer, and she told us, she was in Utah, and she told us, you cannot cancel Sundance.
That's
Gerilyn Dreyfuss.
who did the
Oh, she's
who
made
was
it.
Our savior.
But the Bombay
Born into brothels,
Academy Award.
Yeah. So the funny story is the first apartment I ever stay in is the director Ross Kaufman's flat in
New York.
What? Just by chance.
We're learning
isn't that
a lot
funny?
Of things today.
On this show.
So you reality says this film isn't over, but you go to Sundance with something that's a rough.
We went to Sundance.
At the end, I would imagine.
Well, we went to Sundance actually with a film that we felt was actually, you know, as a film, it did stand on its own 2 feet. We were proud of it, but we felt like there was more to do. And we knew that as we were on our way to Sundance. So
it wins the.
It won an audience award.
Right.
Which was so. It was so crucial to be able to continue because you have a team that has been working on this film, that has been living on fumes, that is getting a vote of support from people halfway across the world, basically saying the story matters. And it made a difference. It gave another boost to be able to continue.
Well, it made us know that what we had captured was
reading
was something that was universal.
I can imagine actually that because you are so in the middle of it yourselves, you don't have a sense of is an audience that hasn't been there and hasn't smelt it and felt it and all of that, is it going to get that?
One of the really interesting things that I found and you know watching the various cuts is that you over time you kind of begin to realize that there are real life consequences for beats that are missing. So, for example, and this is one of the kind of early discussions that happened, you'd presume when you're making a film about the revolution, right, that you would be able to start it on this note, which is that everyone knows there were these 18 days and Mubarak left power and everyone was happy, right? And then what happened next? You presume that would be your starting point. What really happened is that when you're on that next step of the line is 800 people died last week. And the people who decided to take power while those people were being killed are still in government. And so 2 weeks later, people continue to go down to the streets. If you miss that second part, then when they go down onto the streets having celebrated and got rid of their president, then it just seems like they're greedy. Ah, we want more. We want to get rid of this. We want to do that. When you understand the fundamental things moving people from inside, then, and this is what I'm saying, the narrative of the film, when you understand it, makes sense of real political decisions that people are making in the world. And this is true likewise, for example, in relation to this whole dichotomy that got very confusing for the rest of the world in terms of, hang on, but you had elections and you got a president and then you went out and got rid of him. Shouldn't you wait 4 years until the term's up? I mean, that's what everyone else does. And it's not like we always get presidents who we like either, without understanding the fundamental aspect of the fact that in Egypt, you know, that a democracy here, for example, has a checks and balance system, not for all parts of its power structure, but for some parts of its power structure. There is an independent judiciary. There is the possibility of impeaching. There is all of these various aspects. When you don't have that, and then a president who comes to power decides to make himself the sole legislative and executive authority in the country, and in order to push through a constitution that is entirely tailor-made around his one group's political and ideological interests, then it only becomes a matter of times as things keep getting worse and as the future keeps getting darker that the only place left for you is the street. That's about where you hold power accountable.
Let me just say, we are at the end of this, which I feel like is like the movie itself. Yeah, wow. In other words,
we've only just begun.
I know. I mean, I love the hour we've spent together, and I want to say just a couple of things, if I may. One is that the West fetishizes elections, as if democracy equals elections equals democracy.
Thank you for saying that.
And what you're talking about is that, in fact, that's not democracy. And
the most important aspect of democracy is participation.
Absolutely.
If you only participate once every 4 years by ticking a box, then you are not participating.
That's right. And the thing that we see Ahmed say several times, you know, his thing is we must bring down the regime. Yeah. But what he begins to realize is the regime is not Mubarak. It's not Morsi. The regime is whatever dominates the people.
And it's the society of conscience that he's talking about in the end, which is the idea that people need to continue. You know, we see our characters go through this entire trajectory. And in the end, after going through this whole process, they realize that no one leader or no one political process is going to deliver the demands of the revolution.
And it's not going to fit what they thought it would be. And it's not going to fit what the West wants it to be. It's not going to fit what Al Jazeera wants it to be or CNN.
And the only way that the narrative is going to truly be broken is by Egyptians to be participating in the writing of that narrative on an active basis. And I think that why the film is starting to register so much around the world is that this is tapping into a global zeitgeist, a moment where, there is an attempt with people power bubbling up in different pockets around the world, in different squares, that are trying to rewrite the social contract. And the sooner we understand that this is part of a global reconstruction that we're a part of, the sooner we can start to understand what's happening in places like Egypt. So maybe,
if you will, the sooner some of it comes back here to the U.S.
Well, because it's a double, and that's, we feel, is part of our obligation
exactly.
to share.
We've got to cut it off or we're going to end up in mid-sentence. I'm going to read one quote that's on your website, which goes to right what we were saying. We go to the square to discover that we love life outside it and to discover that our love for life is resistance.
That is Alaa Abdel Fattah.
Yeah. This has been amazing. So again, the film is The Square. To find out where it's playing and to learn more, go to thesquarefilm.com. Thank you, Shahan Najim.
Thank you.
Director.
This is great.
Kareem Amir, producer.
Thank you.
Khaled Abdallah, participant. Keep up the good work. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. Same website if you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be and what we're going to talk about and three or four articles of background. Sign up at my site or email me at T-E-McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y @mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.
And check out thesquarefilm.com, and hopefully we can provide you with a platform to connect to others who care about creating the society of conscience that this film is trying to spark a conversation around.
And where to see it.
It's
playing in LA at the Sunset and the Lemley.
People will see it.
Yeah.
Trust,
yeah.
They will.
Okay.
Yes.